Only about 2 months ago.
And when did Ann Berkshire start volunteering here? Palmer thought about this.
Around the same time, actually.
And when did Joey Scott come here as a patient? For this, Palmer had to consult her computer.
That's funny.
What? Asked Decker sharply.
Well, Joey came here 9 weeks ago. That means all three of them around the same time. What a coincidence.
I don't think it was a coincidence, said Decker. Palmer looked at him strangely, but Decker ignored this and plunged on. When we first met, you said that Joey was going to be adopted, but the couple pulled out when he got sick.
That's right. Disgusting.
How did you come by that information?
Come by it?
Who told you?
Oh, it was the caseworker that came with Joey when he was admitted here. She told me. She was as upset by it as I was.
So the story is that Joey was going to be adopted, but then the adoptive parents found out he was terminal and decided against adopting him.
That's right.
Do you have Joey's medical file?
Yes.
I know you can't share the details with us, per se, but can you tell us when he was diagnosed with leukemia? Palmer looked uncomfortable with this, but consulted her computer. Once more, her face displayed amazement.
I don't understand. This doesn't make any sense. I'm surprised I didn't put two and two together before. About what?
Said Jameson. Decker answered, Anyone with cancer is going to go through treatment, especially a child who could conceivably have his whole life ahead of him. With Joey's form of leukemia, he probably had been diagnosed years ago, had the whole spectrum of treatments until it was determined that nothing else could be done. Then he came here. So the couple that wanted to adopt Joey would have known all of this long ago. They would have had no reason to unadopt him. Palmer said emphatically,
That's right. That's exactly right.
Decker looked around. This is a nice hospice, a private hospice. How can an orphan like Joey afford this place?
Oh, well, the couple I was talking about, they had some goodness in them. They've been paying the bills here for Joey. So they're paying the hospice bills of a kid they unadopted and never come to visit,
said Jameson.
How does that make sense?
Decker said, It doesn't at one level, but it does at another. How did Joey end up coming to this place? He asked Palmer.
It was the couple. They paid the bills, and so they got to pick the place.
So Berkshire and Jenkins both started coming here after Joey was here.
Yes, that's right, shortly thereafter, but Joey was here first.
And Berkshire asked to read to Joey?
Yes.
How did she know he was even here? This puzzled Palmer.
I'm not sure. I do remember her coming in and asking if we had any children. She said she wanted to bolster their spirits.
I'm sure. And the only young child you had at the time was Joey?
Why, yes, it's unusual for a little boy or girl to be in a hospice, but it does happen, unfortunately.
Right, said Decker.
As I said, I thought their paying his bills made up a little for them abandoning Joey.
Yeah, well, you can stop thinking that.
What?
Said a startled Palmer. Do you have their name and address?
That's confidential.
And I'm afraid I'm going to have to insist.
Why?
Because they've been using your hospice to pass stolen classified information to enemies of this country. If that doesn't work for you, we can always get a warrant and surround this place with a SWAT team. Your call. Chapter 63. Upper Massachusetts Avenue on the way to Maryland. It was the land of foreign embassies and enormous and vintage private residences. Old money and new dollars uneasily commingled here. Unless one had a net worth in excess of 9 figures, one did not get to live in this area. And it was a neighborhood unaccustomed to having a police presence unless it involved a visiting foreign dignitary and a motorcade with flags on the fenders.
Okay, Decker, I hope to hell you're right about this, said Bogart nervously.
He, Milligan, and Jameson were seated in a parked car across the street from a 1930s Tudor-style mansion fronted by iron gates and a high stone wall. Decker said, I hope I am too.
Let's do this.
They got out and approached the house. Bogart spoke into a walkie-talkie.
Everybody in place? All points covered?
The response came and he nodded.
Okay, he said.
They reached the gates and Bogart punched the button on the call box. There was a screechy sound, but no voice came on. He hit it again with the same result.
FBI, please open the gates.
Again, there was no response.
This is the FBI. Please open the gates or we will be forced to open them by force.
Nothing.
Nobody home? Wondered Bogart.
He looked around and pulled out the walkie-talkie again.
Breacher up.
A minute later, a truck roared up and two men in SWAT gear climbed out. They unloaded a hydraulic-powered ram set up on a wheeled platform.
Hit it, said Bogart.
They powered up the ram, set it against the gate, locked the wheels down, and one of the men hit a button on a remote he held. The piston-powered punch shot forward and smacked the gate squarely in the middle. They broke open.
Hit it, said Bogart into his walkie-talkie.
A SWAT team poured out of the truck and dashed up the long drive. On the other sides of the property, other FBI agents scaled the wall and charged toward the mansion. Bogart, Milligan, Decker, and Jameson followed closely behind the SWAT team. They reached the front doors, where the lead agent pounded on the wood and announced the FBI's presence. There was no answer.
Take it down, ordered Bogart.
The portable ram was brought up, and it slammed against the doors, bursting them open. The agents poured through. It was an enormous house, with lots of places to hide, but they didn't have to look very hard. The library was a beautiful room, book-lined with a marble mantle topping a mammoth blackened fireplace. An ornate writing desk was set in the middle, a high-backed leather chair situated at the knee hole. There was a black leather sofa against one wall, and two wing chairs on the other side of a wood and wrought iron metal coffee table that had probably set the owners back five figures. Not that they cared anymore. The man was in one of the chairs. The woman was sprawled across the couch. They each bore the blackened tag of a bullet entry smack in the middle of their foreheads.
Alfred and Julia Gorski, said Bogart.
They're taking care of loose ends, opined Milligan. Bogart said,
We need to search this place from top to bottom.
I'll call in the tag and bag team, said Milligan. He pulled out his phone and moved over to a far corner of the room. Bogart looked at Decker.
So they used this dying kid as a means to pass classified material?
Decker nodded. They knew Joey was dying. That's why they picked him to adopt. They never had any intention of doing that. They brought him to Dominion Hospice, and that's why Berkshire started going there. It was a perfect cover to pass the secrets. I mean, who would have suspected? We discovered that Jenkins got the job as the night manager when the woman who'd originally held the position didn't show up for work. I wonder when they'll find her body.
Damn, this thing just keeps expanding, exclaimed Bogart, rubbing the back of his neck.
So does the universe, replied Decker. A voice said,
But the good news is we're dismantling their spy operation by default. They've now lost four operatives and counting.
They turned to see Harper Brown standing in the doorway. She came forward and looked down at the couple.
You know them, said Bogart.
I know of them. The Gorskis host charity balls, cut ribbons on hospital wings, throw great parties, one of which the head of my agency has attended.
What's their background? Asked Bogart.
They were immigrants from Poland, built a huge import-export company. I guess we know what they were importing and exporting now,
said Jameson.
I'm surprised if they're so prominent that they didn't get negative publicity for what they did with Joey, said Bogart. I mean, not adopting him.
Brown said,
That's why you have PR people, and they were paying for his stay at hospice. No one's going to ding them after that if anyone really even knew about it. They've funded construction of a new at-risk youth facility in Southeast. No one's going to hold one kid against them, as awful as that sounds. I wonder how the PR folks will spin their being spies,
snapped Jameson.
Bogart said to Brown, How did you end up here?
Brown looked at Jameson.
Alex called me and told me. I appreciate the heads up. You're welcome.
said Jameson, as Decker gave her a curious glance.
Do you have any idea who the Gorskys could have been working for? Said Bogart.
Obvious suspects are the Russians, of course, but you can't rule out the Chinese, the North Koreans, or some of the players in the Middle East.
Jameson said,
Would Middle Eastern terrorists use people like the Gorskys? You wouldn't think they would trust them. Lots of people who look like you and me have been radicalized,
replied Brown.
The same for North Korea and the Chinese, and sometimes it comes down to money.
Well, if the Gorskys had been this rich for decades and have been spying this whole time, we might be able to rule out the Middle East, said Decker. That didn't come into play really until after 9/11.
You'd be surprised,
said Brown.
Were the Gorskys in a position to actually steal the secrets, asked Bogart, or were they bankrolling those who did?
The latter. Neither of the Gorskys could have come into contact with places where the secrets are actually located. But they also moved in high circles, and they came into contact with people who do have those secrets. Some at the highest levels. I'm talking politicians, military, bureaucrats, executive leadership of defense contractors. They've all probably been in this house at some point.
That's a lot of very high-level possibilities, said Bogart.
Just calling it like I see it, Agent Bogart.
So we think the secrets that Walter Dabney stole moved through this network?
I wouldn't be surprised to find that the Gorskys paid off Natalie's gambling debts in exchange for the classified information. It might have gone from Dabney directly to Berkshire. She then passed it along to Jenkins, and he on up the chain.
She looked at Bogart.
My people have broken the code in the Harry Potter book.
And?
There were at least 9 months of classified info on there in various colors that fluoresce. As we suspected, that included a back door into 3 highly sensitive DIA databases. That was what we believed Dabney stole. Our undercover ops overseas have been severely compromised. We've already lost 5 assets on the ground because of it.
But Dabney wasn't stealing secrets 9 months ago, pointed out Bogart. His came later, when Natalie got into trouble with the gambling.
He's obviously not the only spy they were working with,
said Brown.
But surely he wouldn't have had that information simply because he was a contractor to DIA,
said Jameson.
That sounds more like something you guys would keep internally. It absolutely was. But Dabney used his relationship with key people there to ferret out the entry passcodes for that data. We figured all this out after the fact, of course, but by then the damage was already done.
What assets? Asked Decker. That might narrow down who's behind this.
Syria and Libya.
Does that help us take some players out of the equation? Said Decker.
30 years ago it might have, but Russia is so heavily invested in the Middle East's geopolitical equation that they could be behind it. Putin is ruthless, and he has firmly in mind a plan to make Mother Russia a global player once more. And to do that, he needs influence everywhere, particularly in the desert. And we can't rule out China either because they have similar goals. All you need is to see what they're doing in the South China Sea to understand that. And both countries are beefing up their military capabilities. And then you have Un in North Korea as a wild card who's determined to build a nuke that can reach the West Coast. Sounds like doomsday is coming sooner rather than later,
said Jameson in a resigned voice.
Unless we can knock out spy operations like this, I wouldn't make any retirement plans,
said Brown.
They might prove unnecessary,
she added ominously. Chapter 64. Decker was sitting on the couch with his eyes closed and his head tilted down. Jameson had just walked out of the bathroom dressed in a long shirt with gym shorts. She was brushing her teeth with one hand and carrying a small plastic bag of trash with the other. She padded barefoot down the hall, glanced at Decker, shrugged, and dropped the plastic bag into a large trash receptacle located on one side of the kitchen island. That's when the knock came at the door. Jameson looked around and observed that Decker did not appear to have heard the knock. She tried to speak, and watery toothpaste dribbled out of her mouth. She caught it in one hand and hurried over to the sink. She rinsed out her mouth. The knock came again.
Decker, can you get the door?
He didn't budge, and his eyes didn't open.
I'll take that as a no,
exclaimed Jameson. She used a paper towel to wipe off her mouth and hurried over to the door. She looked through the peephole, and her eyes widened.
Yes,
she said through the door. Four men stood outside, all dressed in suits. One of them held up his open cred pack to the peephole.
Holy shit,
Jameson muttered. She opened the door and stepped back. The four men didn't move. The one in the lead looked her up and down and then glanced over at Decker, who still sat on the couch. Amos Decker, he said.
Yes,
said Jameson.
I mean, that's us. I mean...
Flustered, she drew a quick breath, composed herself, and said,
I'm Alex Jameson, and he's Amos Decker.
I'm Special Agent Nathan Deal with the United States Secret Service. Mr. Decker, you need to come with us.
When?
Asked Jameson. Now.
Why?
She asked. Now. Decker opened his eyes and looked over at them. You better go change, Alex. The invitation did not include your friend, said Deal sharply. Then I'm not going, said Decker. He closed his eyes and settled back on the couch. Deal glanced at one of his men and then at Jameson. Our orders are for him only.
Decker,
said Jameson.
It's the Secret Service, for Christ's sake.
Unless they have a warrant for my arrest, I don't go unless you go. And if you guys want to try to carry me out of here, be advised that I'm a big load. Deal frowned, took out his phone, and stepped down the hall. A minute went by before he rejoined them. Deal let out a long breath, glanced at Jameson, and nodded curtly. Okay, you're in. She stared at him open-mouthed for a long moment and then said,
Can you give me like 10 minutes to change?
Make it like 5. We have people waiting. She raced off down the hall into her bedroom and slammed the door behind her. Deal stepped into the apartment, looked over at Decker, and took in his rumpled clothes and general dishevelment. Do you need to change clothes and clean up too? Decker stood, towering over the man. There wouldn't be much point. Why? Snapped Deal. Because all of my clothes look just like these. Surprisingly, Deal cracked a smile. I was told you walked to the beat of a different drummer. It's actually refreshing.
Oh my freaking God,
exclaimed Jameson. She had changed into slacks, a short-waisted jacket, and a white blouse with black boots. She'd done her hair up in the back and secured it there with a barrette. She and Decker were in the very back row of a big-ass GMC Yukon with tinted windows. She was staring up at the White House. God doesn't live there, said Decker. The president does.
I can't believe this is happening.
I've been there before, actually. She gaped.
The White House? How? When?
The year the Buckeyes won the national championship. We had a booster who was rolling in money and had connections to the administration back then. He got us in. Met the president. Got the photo op. Pretty cool. I was only 20.
You never told me that.
I guess not.
Where's the photo?
It got lost over the years.
You took a picture with the president and you lost it?
Well, yeah, he said indifferently. She shook her head.
Why am I not surprised?
They pulled through a side gate and the Yukon stopped at a doorway. The agents escorted them into the White House and down a hallway to a small room. Inside the room were Bogart and Brown. Moving in exalted circles tonight, said Bogart with a smile tacked on.
How exalted?
Jameson wanted to know.
National Security Council,
replied Brown.
Not the full council, but enough.
Bogart said, I didn't expect to see you tonight, Alex. It wasn't my call to leave you out of things, but I got overruled.
Decker told them he wouldn't come unless I came too.
Bogart grinned. Can't say I'm surprised. You guys are a team, after all.
A broad smile broke over Jameson's face. Nathan Deal returned and said briskly, Let's go. They were led through several long passageways until they arrived at a set of doors. Deal opened the doors and ushered them inside before closing the doors behind them. The conference table was long and rectangular. There were TV screens on the wall, all dark and silent. 6 people were seated around the table. Jameson recognized the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Homeland Security. Then her gaze alighted on a woman she did not know, but would later learn was the National Security Advisor, or NSA. There was a broad-shouldered gent in a naval full-dress uniform, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and finally, at the head of the table, was the President of the United States. Jameson took a deep breath and tried to calm her nerves. In her ear, Bogart whispered, "His being here tells you how serious this is." The President asked them to sit. They all immediately did so. The President looked at Bogart. "Agent Bogart, I'm due to give out an award shortly to the FBI for a successful joint mission that saved a great many lives."
"Yes, sir, I'm aware of that."
"Well, if your team can help us with this, I think another award will be in order." The President turned to the woman. "Gail, you want to start this off?"
"Thank you, Mr. President,"
said Gail Charles, the NSA. She nodded at the visitors and said,
"The Council has been briefed on the matter at hand, and we want to ask some follow-up questions as well as impart some additional information that might be relevant to your investigation."
Bogart lifted his hand.
"Ms. Charles, just so we're crystal clear, while Agent Brown and I are cleared for any such discussion, Agents Decker and Jameson may not be."
Charles said,
"We are aware of the pending security clearances, and we feel comfortable proceeding under the current scenario."
"Understood. Thank you."
Charles continued in a businesslike tone.
"The latest development regarding the Gorskys. Has any information come to light after the search of their home?"
Bogart said,
"We are still searching, but we have found nothing that would tie them into aspiring. I think it doubtful that we will, in fact."
"But you're still confident that they are involved somehow in espionage?"
"We are very confident. They provided financial assistance to a young boy at a hospice in Reston. A book being read to this young boy by Anne Berkshire, who we are certain is a spy, contained coded classified information stolen from various agencies. In addition, on my way here tonight, I was informed that we traced a financial wire going from a Gorsky corporate account to an account in Switzerland. From there, the money went to Estonia and then disappeared en route to what we believe is an account in France. This, we think, was the payoff for the gambling debt that caused Walter Dabney to steal classified secrets." The President cleared his throat and said,
"So you think it's the Russians behind this?"
Bogart said, "Sir, let's just say that while we're considering all possible players, our investigations are pointing toward Russia being involved."
"Well, considering the hacking they've been doing to us, I guess we shouldn't be surprised. They're showing their muscle in the skies, on the seas, and in the cyber world."
Brown said,
"As Admiral Howard here has been told, sir, the information most recently stolen from us has compromised our undercover operations overseas. As of 2 hours ago, we have now lost 10 operatives, and while it may very well be Russia behind this, we can't rule out the possibility that Russia is partnering with certain regional powers in the Middle East to carry this out. The majority of our lost operatives were in Syria, Libya, and Yemen. While Russia has strategic interests in that sector, so do several countries in the Middle East, Iran and Saudi Arabia included among them."
Charles said,
"We are well aware that Moscow is aligning itself with certain regional powers, and I'm not simply talking about obvious ones like Assad. The loss of those operatives is unfortunate and can't be allowed to stand without a response."
Admiral Howard interjected, "Knowing definitively who is involved in this would allow us to craft a precise response, no more and no less than is called for." The President eyed Howard before focusing on Decker.
"Agent Decker, I spent part of this afternoon being debriefed on you."
"I hope it wasn't wasted time," said Decker. Bogart gave a sharp intake of breath, but the President smiled.
"On the contrary, it was very informative and interesting. We are fortunate to have someone with your abilities working on our side."
"I just try to get to the truth."
"Well, you picked a challenging city in which to do that."
"Yes, sir."
"Do you have theories on how we might get to that truth?"
Decker looked down for a few moments. Bogart glanced at him, seemingly afraid that Decker was not going to respond. Just as he was about to speak, Decker stirred. "Most or all the facts we need to solve this, I think we have. We just have to put them in the right order. The key questions for me are, Why did Walter Dabney kill Ann Berkshire, and why in front of the FBI building? Next, who assisted him that day dressed as a clown? How did Walter Dabney, who Agent Brown does not believe ever stole classified information before now, come to hook up with a longtime spy like Ann Berkshire in the first place? There had to be a catalyst. Last, what was in Dabney's safe deposit box that he was forced to remove shortly before his death?
All good questions, and to which I hope you speedily find the correct answers, said the president. He looked at his NSA. And now we need to provide you some information which may prove germane to your investigation, and perhaps lend it even more urgency. It's why we called you here tonight, in fact.
All eyes were fixed on Charles. She took out an electronic notebook and scrolled through some digital pages.
This just came in, which prompted our meeting tonight. The Joint Chiefs have been briefed, as has the full council.
She paused to read down the lines on the page and continued.
As you probably know, the secrets stolen by Mr. Dabney may have allowed enemies of this country to hack into some of our more secure databases. That was worrisome enough. Now our colleagues over at Fort Meade have picked up chatter suggesting strongly that an attack on this country is imminent. We don't know what shape or form the attack will take, but the quarters we're receiving this from, though they have no idea we're listening in, have been very reliable in the past.
No idea as to the target?
Asked Brown quickly.
Based on further analysis just completed, we believe that the target may be symbolic, somehow. The world has become a very different place in a fairly short time. We have a new Cold War starting up at the same time we have hot spots erupting all over the Middle East. Fascist movements are taking root in some of the governments of allies of ours, and much of the world is a tinderbox, so we can't rule out any possibility, quite frankly. And if an attack does come and we identify its source, we will have no choice but to respond accordingly, and that could set in motion a chain of events that could have global repercussions of the most negative kind.
Admiral Howard cleared his throat and said, "The military agrees with that assessment." As does the State Department, added the Secretary of State. The head of Homeland Security nodded in agreement. Decker voiced the obvious question. You called us here tonight because you evidently believe your concerns are connected to our case. Why is that? Charles glanced at the president, who nodded. She turned to Decker and said,
Because the chatter we intercepted was all Arabic, except for one word.
What word?
It was a name, rather.
What name? Asked Bogart.
Dabney.
Chapter 65.
I've got to call my mom,
said Jameson when they got back to their apartment. Why? Asked Decker.
Do you really have to ask?
She said incredulously.
I just met the president.
That meeting was classified, Alex. You can't talk about it to anyone. You can't even acknowledge it ever happened. Jameson looked doubtfully at her phone.
Maybe I could tell a little white lie and say we just ran into each other.
You just ran into the President of the United States? Where? At the gas station? Or a Starbucks? She put her phone down.
I guess you're right.
Decker took off his jacket and hung it up on a peg by the door. Dabney, he said.
I know, that's really weird, to hear all those words in Arabic and then to hear that name. Freaky.
Decker sat down on the couch and put his feet up on the coffee table. Jameson perched on the arm of the couch.
I wonder if Melvin and Harper have gone on a second date yet.
Yeah, I'm surprised she didn't bring it up in the Situation Room at the White House. The president was probably wondering, too. She cuffed him on the shoulder.
You know what I mean.
I just don't like to get caught up in other people's lives like that.
But getting caught up in other people's lives is a really big part of most people's lives, Decker.
Not mine. She sighed.
The meeting tonight puts things in a whole new perspective. I mean, if an attack on this country is planned, we need to solve this thing really soon.
Decker closed his eyes. She stared at him in disbelief.
Are you going to zone out on me? If so, I'll just go to my room and go to sleep.
Okay. Good night. She pushed his legs out of the way, sat down next to him, and said,
Damn it, Decker, will you please talk to me?
He looked at her, clearly annoyed, What do you want me to say, Alex?
Our country is going to be attacked. What are we going to do to stop it?
I'm thinking about it. I am working on it, but I'm not a magician.
But everyone thinks you are, me included. The things you can do, it's amazing. You never fail.
I actually fail lots of times, and I'm not a damn machine. So if you're worried about the sky falling, don't look to me to fix it. He abruptly stood, grabbed his jacket, and headed out.
Decker, wait, I didn't...
But he had already slammed the door behind him. He trotted down the stairs and out into the coolness of the night, and he started walking, each exhaled breath releasing tiny clouds into the sky. He was angry, and he didn't want to be. He knew that Jameson was actually complimenting him, voicing her complete confidence in his abilities, but he was feeling the pressure of preventing an attack. Even in his altered state, where he didn't get normal social cues, he clearly understood what was at stake. This was a long way from being a PI in a Rust Belt town back in Ohio, hustling for clients in all the wrong places. Not that long ago, I was living in a cardboard box. Now I'm supposed to be the savior of the country? How effed up is that? He shoved his hands into his pockets, pointed his head down, and kept walking. He reached the river and stood and looked out over the expanse of water. It mirrored his thoughts, dark, murky, deep. He had to get traction on this case, something to hang on to. There were so many moving parts, and just when he thought he had something, it fell apart or was overtaken by a new development. Was that intentional? Are they trying to keep us reactive? He shut his eyes and let the frames roll through. It occurred to Decker that this process was like how the old-time animators would do their job, drawing slightly different versions of a character on multiple pieces of paper that you would then flip through to show motion. Well, he was hoping for some motion of the forward variety. He decided to begin at the beginning. One more time. And something had just occurred to him. It had to do with real estate. He made the phone call, and on the third ring, Faye Thompson, Walter Dabney's partner, picked up.
What is it?
She said when Decker identified himself. I was just wondering about something.
Look, I'm up to my ass in lawyers and federal investigators. I don't have time.
If you cooperate, it will look better for you, interjected Decker. He heard her sigh, and then she said,
What do you want to know?
When you joined the firm, it was doing well?
Yes, very well.
How about when Dabney first started out? Was he in the same office space you're in now?
Of course not. It was only him way back when. So he didn't need that much space, and he couldn't have afforded it anyway.
Because he was building up his business.
Yes, it takes a lot of work and hard times to build something like Walter did. He started out on a shoestring and slowly built from there. He maxed out his credit cards more than once, I heard. But he was hugely successful in the end.
So money was tight.
Well, if you have plenty of cash, why would you max out your credit cards?
She said snidely. Right. I understand that he had a yellow Porsche when he still worked at NSA.
I know nothing about that. Are we done here?
She added. I had one more question about his house, but Thompson had already hung up on him. Next, Decker used his phone not to make a call but to order an Uber. Jameson had set an account up on his phone a few weeks ago. 5 minutes later, he was heading to Virginia. It seemed chillier on this side of the Potomac as the car pulled up the stately drive. The car stopped in front of the house, and Decker got out. His knock was answered by Samantha. She looked like she had been crying.
What do you want?
She said in an unfriendly tone. Is your mother here?
She's in bed. Can't you leave us alone?
I wish I could, said Decker, but I can't. Can I come in?
Why?
Please? She stepped to the side and allowed him to pass. She closed the door and stared up at him.
Well?
So you all have lived here since you were little?
Yes.
In this house?
Yes.
Jules came out of another room and saw Decker.
What are you doing here?
She demanded. Just asking a few questions.
What does our living in this house when we were little have to do with a damn thing?
Said Samantha. I'm not sure at this point. So your parents have lived here for what, 35 years? Jules said,
About that, I guess. I'm 37, and it's the only place I remember.
I saw some family photo albums in the library. Do you mind if I look through them?
Why?
Said Jules. Because this case has taken on a heightened sense of urgency. We have reason to believe that unless we solve it, something bad is going to happen in this country. Jules and Samantha exchanged glances. Jules said,
You're bullshitting us.
Decker stared back at her. I really wish I were. She looked taken aback by his words.
Look, if you want to pore through old photo albums, knock yourself out.
Leaving Samantha in the hall, Jules led him to the library, pulled the albums off the shelf, and set them down on the coffee table. When she started to leave, Decker said, Do you mind sitting here with me to answer questions I might have? Jules sighed resignedly, but sat next to him as he picked up the first one.
The albums were arranged chronologically, so Decker was able to get where he wanted to go relatively quickly.
These are your grandparents? He said, pointing to several old photos. Jules nodded and pointed.
My dad's mom and dad. They're dead now. They were from Princeton, New Jersey. We used to go and visit them. He was a professor of political science there.
Impressive. They look like they were pretty well off.
No, they lived in a house provided by the university. I know my dad helped them out financially when they got older.
He pointed to another photo. And these folks?
My mom's parents. They lived in Oregon.
Did you visit them out there?
No, I never knew them. They had a small farm. They died in a mudslide when my mom was little. It swept the entire property away, the house, barn, everything. Her parents' bodies were never found. She was at school or she would have been killed too. After that, she went to an orphanage, then came east when she was an adult.
How did your parents meet? Jules's features softened.
It was sort of romantic, actually. My dad was working in Maryland right out of college. My mom worked as a waitress at a cafe near there. She was putting herself through college. Some of the people at Dad's work would go there for breakfast and lunch. She would wait on him, and they struck up a friendship. Mom was a knockout back then, and I'm pretty sure she had plenty of suitors. When she got off work one night, he was waiting in the parking lot with flowers and tickets to a play at the National Theater. Needless to say, they hit it off. The rest is history.
Very nice. So your mom didn't come from money?
From money? No. Not that I know of. Why?
Just something somebody said. It's not important. He closed the album.
Anything else?
Asked Jules. Have you heard from Natalie? Jules nodded.
She sounded okay. She said she was so sorry for everything.
And what did you say to that? Jules shrugged.
I hate what she did. I mean, it totally destroyed our family. But she's still my sister.
I get that. Family is family. He rose. She said,
Have you found who killed Sissy?
Not yet. Still working on it.
I don't understand any of this. I really don't.
Well, you wouldn't be alone on that. Decker left the house, then turned around to look at its exterior. He should have seen this before, he knew. He had two possible conclusions. Now, he just had to see which one was right. Chapter 66 $849,000, said Milligan. They closed on the property a little over 35 years ago. Tax tables show it's worth probably four times that now, and even more on the open market. Wish I had that kind of asset in my retirement future. Decker looked over his shoulder. They were in Milligan's office at the WFO. Decker had returned home the previous night and apologized to Jameson for walking out. She had, in turn, apologized to him for her comments.
We're all under a lot of pressure,
she'd said.
But you, probably more than anybody else. I didn't mean to add to your burden.
And they had left it at that. Decker looked at the computer screen and said, 35 years ago, a couple years after Jules was born. Right. And Dabney was still working at the NSA? Right. He'd been there about 4 years by then, started right out of college. He left to start his own firm 6 years later. Do we know what his salary was at NSA? Ballpark, yes, and to jump to answering your obvious next question, it could not have supported the purchase of that house. So at age 26, he bought a mansion. Definitely should have been a red flag for someone. Do we know if they paid cash or took on debt? That's the rub. The documents I found showed that they put $400,000 down and financed the rest. His wife had a job back then, too. She worked at a real estate firm as a realtor. Could her income have covered it? Not all of it, no. Not even combined with his. But where did the $400,000 down payment come from? You would think the NSA would have asked the same question. Maybe they did, and it was satisfactorily answered, replied Decker. Maybe, said Milligan. Then we can try to ask them, but my experience is you don't get fast answers from those guys, if you get answers at all. Bogart's been trying to get them to respond to questions about Dabney, and so far, all he's gotten back is silence. He looked at Decker. What made you think about all this? Big expensive house purchased by a young couple without a lot of money? Pretty basic. I guess we should have seen that too. But it's all perspective, I suppose. Dabney was super successful over the years, and his house just sort of fit the picture of that success. I didn't think about the timing of the purchase all those years ago. Cecilia Randall also told me that Dabney bought a yellow Porsche around the same time as they closed on the house. And she said that she thought Mrs. Dabney came from money, the way she dressed and conducted herself. Now, Jules did tell me that Ellie's parents were killed in a mudslide and she was sent to an orphanage. Maybe she got compensation from that. But if that were the case, why would you be working as a waitress to put yourself through college? You wouldn't, replied Milligan. So if we can find out the source of the money, maybe we can figure out what happened all these years later. You think they're connected? I think they have to be. Dabney was an NSA. He certainly would have had access to classified material. And then he starts his own firm. I know we were speculating that he only recently committed espionage to help Natalie, but do you think he might have been spying all these years? Hard to say. He might have worked with Berkshire over 3 decades ago and then quit spying for some reason, and somehow turned back to her all these years later to sell the secrets and get the payoff to help his daughter. That might solve the question of why we could show no connection between them. We didn't look back 3 decades. I think you might be on the right track, Decker. On the other hand, Dabney couldn't have killed Cecilia Randall. He was already dead. We don't know for sure that her murder is connected. It might just be a random killing. Decker shook his head. I don't think so. If he has been a spy all this time, it's not going to be easy for his family to learn this. Not after everything else they've been through. Nothing about this case has been easy, replied Decker. He left Milligan and walked down the hall to an office he was sharing with Jameson. He filled her in on his discussion with Milligan.
That theory does fill in some holes,
she said. But it doesn't get us any closer to who's behind this or where they might be planning to strike. And that's what we really need to find out.
I spoke with Bogart a few minutes ago. They found nothing helpful at the Gorskys' home.
Decker sat down across from her and stared at the ceiling.
But you're not satisfied with your own theory?
Why do you say that? He asked.
Because I know you. I can tell.
He turned his head to look at her. Okay, you're right. I'm not satisfied.
What would make you satisfied?
Something that makes total sense, not piecemeal.
You might not get that.
I'm coming around to that possibility. He put his size 14s up on the desk and leaned back in his chair.
Heard from Harper Brown?
Asked Jameson. Not a word.
She and Melvin saw each other again.
How do you know that?
I talked to Melvin just now. They went to lunch. Well, a picnic, really, at Roosevelt Island. He said they had a great time.
I'm glad she can find time for pleasure while working a case involving the fate of the country.
Everybody needs to take a break now and then,
said Jameson. So now you're defending her, said Decker with a snort.
Hey, I'm a progressive. We're always moving forward, not backward.
Decker stood. Well, I'm looking to make some progress, too, so I better get to it.
Where are you going?
Not sure, but I'll let you know how it turns out.
Hey, Decker.
He turned back. What?
Why did you stick up for me with the Secret Service and insist I go to the meeting at the White House, too?
I'm surprised you have to ask.
What do you mean?
That's what I meant when I said I had your back, Alex. He turned and walked out. Chapter 67. Ever think you're looking at a case ass backwards? Harper Brown stared across the width of the cafe table at Decker.
In this case, how so?
He had called her on the way out of the WFO, and they had arranged to meet here. Dabney kills Berkshire, and then himself. The case starts from there, and we proceed linearly.
Right, but there are backstories we have to check out, too, and we have been. This didn't start with him killing her.
Granted, that was the result. But as we've been checking out the histories, it seems that we've been focusing mainly on Dabney.
Well, we can't find out jack shit on Berkshire except that she was definitely a spy. We have nothing else to go on.
In response, Decker pulled the doll out of the backpack he'd brought and set it on the table between them. We have this. She stared at it momentarily before looking up at him in disbelief.
This? A doll? We already know it was probably used to transfer stolen secrets in the hidden compartment, but so what?
Why a doll?
Why not?
Let's play this out logically. You steal secrets, put them in the doll, and carry it to another person, presumably Berkshire.
Right.
So again, why a doll?
Why not? It's innocuous. Most people wouldn't give it a second look.
Well, they might if a guy was carrying it around. It's too large to put in your pocket. And a bag might be searched.
So you're saying the other person was probably a woman?
Either a woman or maybe a man with a little girl.
Wait, do you mean Walter Dabney?
It's possible. The doll might have belonged to one of his daughters. The Bureau determined that this doll was manufactured about 30 years ago. So the Dabney girls are the right age for that. And like you said, it's innocuous. Who would suspect a little girl with a doll of transporting secrets? And these people seem to like using kids as cover. Look at Joey Scott in the book. Brown looked thoughtful.
That's true. So do we ask the daughters directly about the doll?
Yes, we do.
Where did you get that?
Asked a stunned Jules. Decker and Brown were seated in the living room with Jules, her mother, and her two sisters. Ellie exclaimed,
Jules, isn't that your doll, Missy?
Jules took it from Decker and held it.
You're sure it's yours,
said Brown. In response, Jules sniffed the hair and then looked at the doll's left foot.
See the red dots on the shoe? I spilled paint on it when I was little. It wouldn't come out, and I recognized the smell of her hair. Where did you get it?
During the course of the investigation, answered Decker, taking the doll back. When do you remember having it last? Jules sat back.
I don't know. I didn't take it to college.
Her cheeks reddened.
I actually wanted to, but changed my mind. I didn't think to check on it since I got here.
So the doll stayed here, in the house?
Said Brown. Ellie said,
We've kept the girls' bedrooms exactly as they left them for when they come back. They all had dolls. I thought they were all still there.
Her voice broke off.
Sissy kept every room neat and organized.
Can we see them? Asked Decker. Jules led them up to the bedrooms. After she left them, Decker and Brown found three dolls with the same secret compartments behind the batteries.
Shit,
said Brown.
This was Spy Central, apparently. Four daughters and four dolls with secret compartments.
This confirms that Walter Dabney must have known Berkshire. They were working together.
And that explains how they afforded a place like this all those years ago.
Decker looked at her. So you thought of that, too?
I have my moments of epiphany,
she said modestly. Let's check the Dabney's bedroom. It was far larger than the daughter's spaces, with an attached sitting room and a fireplace. They searched the bedroom, then the two large closets. Ellie's was a spacious walk-in. Decker next looked in the ensuite bathroom and went through the drawers in the medicine cabinet, where there were a number of prescription bottles. These included heart meds and cholesterol-lowering drugs and an asthma inhaler. Sucks getting old, thought Decker. He closed the door of the medicine cabinet and rejoined Brown in the bedroom.
No dolls,
she said. They went back downstairs, carrying all the dolls, and re-entered the room where the Dabney women were still sitting. Jules was holding her old doll.
What are you doing with those?
Asked Samantha, indicating the dolls.
We need to take them with us,
said Brown.
Why?
Asked Samantha.
They're evidence.
Samantha was about to say something, but she glanced at Jules and sat back. Decker sat across from Jules. I want to show you this photo again and see if you recognize the woman. He held up Berkshire's photo.
I told you I didn't recognize her,
said Jules. Decker passed the photo around to the others. Ellie and the others shook their heads as they looked at the picture of Berkshire. Imagine her with darker hair, fewer lines on the face, prompted Decker. They studied the photo for a few moments. Jules shook her head.
I really don't know this person.
She looked at her sister and mother. They all, too, shook their heads. Ellie said,
What does all this mean? With the dolls and all, I don't understand.
We don't either, if it's any consolation,
said Brown.
Are you saying that Walt was involved in something having to do with these dolls? How does that make any sense? They were the girls' toys, not his. I never remember him walking around with a doll. It's absurd.
Right now, we're not saying anything,
replied Brown.
We're still in the collecting stage.
They left the house with the dolls and walked to Brown's car. Decker turned around and looked at the house. You know the game kids play, You're Getting Warmer, Warmer?
Yeah.
Well, every time I leave this place, I think I'm getting colder. As they drove off, Brown said,
Melvin and I are having dinner tonight. You and Alex want to join us?
After your wonderful picnic? Brown actually blushed at this comment.
It was wonderful. He brought me flowers.
He glanced at her. You sure you want the company?
We're working our butts off, the fate of the country in the balance. I think a few hours of distraction might actually be good for all of us.
Okay, said Decker. Chapter 68. The dinner had been good and the conversation light and humor-filled. It had been a nice respite from the investigation, allowing them to recharge their batteries. Now the four of them had driven over to Brown's home near Capitol Hill. Jameson stared goggle-eyed at the luxurious interior.
Harper, this place is beautiful.
Brown handed Jameson a glass of wine and said,
Most of it was my grandmother's doing. She had the eye, but I've put in some of my own things, too. A few paintings, that sculpture over there, and some rugs, and a special feature or two.
She added offhandedly.
It's comfortable and cozy.
Yes, it really is.
Decker and Mars were on the other side of the room. In lieu of wine, the pair were each cradling a bottle of Dos Equis. Fun time tonight, said Mars. He was dressed in jeans and a dark green turtleneck that seemed barely able to contain his chiseled physique. Always like hanging with you, Melvin. He looked over and caught Brown eyeing Mars. She smiled appreciatively and turned back to Jameson. And you obviously have a fan in Ms. Brown. Mars took a swig of beer and grinned like a schoolboy. She's fun. Lady's been everywhere, done everything. I've been nowhere and done nothing. He looked around. And she comes from money but doesn't act like it. That's cool in my book. And she's quite an athlete. I mean, she's built like one, but she's got the goods, too. 'Cause you never know, right? We went for a run early this morning. Before your picnic, said Decker. Mars's smile broadened. I know, but we like hanging out together. Anyway, she had no problem keeping up with me. Hell, I think she might have been going easy on me. And she's kind to children and loves puppies. Quite the catch. Mars's smile broadened. I know. I'm just rambling here, being kind of goofy. And I know we don't really know each other all that well, but we just kind of clicked, you know? I know, Melvin, and I'm really happy for you. Decker glanced at his watch. It was late, after midnight. I'm going to finish this beer and then call it a night. The lights went out, sending them into darkness. What the hell? Exclaimed Mars. Did a circuit breaker trip or did a transformer blow outside? Said Decker. He felt someone pass him, and a few moments later, Brown said,
Other homes on the street have power. It must be...
She stopped, turned, and ran back over to them. She grabbed Decker and Mars by the arm.
Move it, now, Jameson, to the right and down the hall.
What's... began Mars, but she had tugged on his hand and pulled them out of the room. A few seconds later, the front and back doors burst open and masked men poured in. They had short-barreled MP5s and night vision goggles, and they opened fire as they swarmed through the house. As Brown and the others sprinted down the hall, Decker, who was bringing up the rear, turned and emptied half his mag. Bullets whizzed past him, exploding a lamp, ripping chunks of plaster off the wall, shredding paintings, and causing bursts of fabric and filling to erupt from furniture. Decker emptied the rest of his ammo, and Jameson opened fire too as they fled down the hall. Brown kicked open a door at the end of the hall and pushed them all through it. She slammed the door shut and turned the lock.
Over here, quick!
Bullets thudded into the door, but none burst through. Decker glanced at her.
Steel lined,
she hissed back. Brown took out her phone, hit a key, and a section of the wall swiftly opened. Behind it was a metal door. This opened on whisper-quiet hydraulics.
Get inside now,
she urged.
Hurry!
They hustled into the revealed room, and Brown hit another key on her phone. The door closed, and the section of wall slid back into place. A light came on in the room, and Decker and the others looked around. There was a TV screen on one wall. It obviously had feed from just outside the door, because they could all see the room they had just been in. As they watched, the door to the room burst open, and the armed men moved inside. Decker said, "We need to call the cops."
My security system automatically did that when I activated the door to the safe room.
So that's what this is,
said Jameson, gazing around.
A safe room? Steel-wrapped, soundproof, bomb-proof, bulletproof, with its own air supply, independent power source, and enough food and water for a week. Plus a portable potty.
Is this room you're doing?
Said Jameson.
It's one of the special features I mentioned.
You need a safe room? Asked Decker.
Given what's happened just now, apparently so. And, Decker, you're bleeding.
She pointed to his face. He rubbed at the spot. Something must have hit me there. It wasn't a bullet, maybe some debris stripped off by the gunfire.
I wasn't that lucky.
They turned to see Mars holding his bloody forearm. Think it's just a graze, but boy, does it burn like a bitch. Brown grabbed a first aid kit from a cubby on the wall and began, with Jameson's assistance, to treat Mars's arm. As Decker watched on the screen, the men searched the room.
Cops are on their way, said Decker.
He could hear the siren sound from the audio feed tied to the TV. Frustrated at not finding them, the masked men sprayed the walls with gunfire, yet none of it could penetrate the shelter they were in. Then the men turned and dashed from the room as the sirens drew ever closer. 4 minutes later, they all emerged from the safe room in time to meet the cops peering cautiously into the room. Brown pulled her creds and did the explaining. The cops looked slowly around at the devastation. One of them said,
"Somebody really doesn't like you, lady."
"Well, that's why you have homeowner's insurance,"
quipped Brown. After the police finished their search and took down particulars, they left, leaving the four to stare anxiously at each other.
"That was close," said Mars. "How did you even know they were coming, Harper?"
"When I looked outside, I saw the red dots on their night vision goggles lined up at the middle of their foreheads. That's because they were wearing an older generation device. Our agencies have phased them out for obvious reasons. Way too big of a target."
"Well, thank God for safe rooms,"
voiced Jameson. "I wonder what the hell they wanted," said Mars, "other than to kill us."
"They must have been following us,"
said Brown,
"and cut the power before making their attack."
"I wonder," said Decker thoughtfully.
"You wonder about what?"
asked Brown. But Decker never answered her. Chapter 69. It was raining once more,